Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, it's a very tree-y show.
It is.
But about different things, of course.
Up and out.
Dr. Richard Bell, who is a research horticulturist at the USDA ARS, which is the Agricultural Research Station, and the Appalachian Fruit Research Area.
I believe you.
Will be joining us to talk about pears.
And then Carol Reese, she's a semi-frequent guest on the show. She's kind of the grand dame of
the South,
Tennessee horticulture. She's funny. I've heard her talk a couple of times. She knows something about everything. And she's going to talk about something we really don't think about enough, the considerations to give yourself in your yard when planting a tree, how far apart, what kind of tree, where to put it, how to plant it. It's more complex than people think.
Well, and she puts an emphasis, I think, on how it can play a role in like cooling your home and, you know, and visually enhancing your home. Some of the things that we don't necessarily think about. And as she, you know, so proudly proclaims, being from the South, the whole concept of a shade tree is something that's very forefront in her mind. You know, so it's a little bit more abstract, I think, than normal, than what you might expect, as she really takes a look at how we should consider trees around our homes.
Well, the one thing I thought about when she was talking about that is, indication of how the world changes. If you have solar panels on your roof, all of a sudden shade trees a problem. So
that's right.
Something you never thought about.
But you can still figure it out somehow, don't you think?
I hope so.
All right, so that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stay with us. Yeah. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Something I'm going to try, I read about and saw in person that sounds counterproductive and wrong, but hat-racking holly trees.
Yeah.
You ever heard about that?
Yeah.
Where you cut them back almost two-thirds to look like just a pole with limbs.
Well, they look really bad for a while,
But holly trees, apparently among all others, will take that and actually improve the beast to do that. So I've got a holly tree I'm unhappy with, and I'm going to hat rack it.
Yeah, basically, like if your holly tree's destroyed or pathetic, they recommend hat racking.
Most other trees you can't do that to.
Mm-mm.
But the holly, so I'm going to try it. I'll report back in about 3 years.
I was going to say, you got to be patient.
Yeah, and we'll see how it goes.
All right.
I want the wishes state.
Sounds
what's up?
Good. Holiday cacti are beginning to bloom just in time for the holidays.
Go figure.
Do you know that I actually have a real Christmas cactus? And let's see, I need to clarify.
Right.
There are what, you know, the store calls Thanksgiving cactus Christmas cactus because, you know, one's blooming at Thanksgiving and one's blooming at Christmas. But a true Christmas cactus has pointy tips on the leaflet.
That's to scare off the reindeer.
The stem, basically it's a modified stem. And then a true Christmas cactus has scalloped.
That welcomes the reindeer.
Yeah.
So that's the reindeer thing.
But I have a Christmas cactus, a salmon-colored Christmas cactus that is beginning to go into full bloom. My trick is I leave them outside as long as I can in the season, and then I put them in the basement. And we have a south-facing windows in our basement.
Oh, yeah.
But there's no on and off of light switches.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually get that regular light and dark in that room because it's not a room that's bothered. So then when they start to, you know, put their buds on and start to bloom, I bring them up and enjoy them.
You're the girl.
Simple as that.
Every year.
It works like a charm.
Do you ever have to cut it back or repot it or something?
I typically don't, no. They're one of those plants that you can, but I will take like parts and stick and make new plants. It's really easy.
Is it big enough now to cover my present when you bring it over?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good.
Okay. But I wouldn't dare try to travel with it because they're just too... Yeah, you'll have to come get it.
Come get it again.
Or you'll have to come visit.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, watch for those holiday cacti beginning to bloom. If you've got some hidden away somewhere, it's time to bring them out and enjoy them. All right, Bob. Everybody enjoys the value of trees in their landscape, don't you think? And there's, you know, not just economic value, but aesthetic value. I think there's probably a calming value to trees but Carol's got more insight.
They take a little thought, a little planning before you do it, and we have the person here to tell us all about that. Carol Reese is a horticulture specialist at the University of Tennessee's Agriculture Extension Service in Jackson, Tennessee. She's a frequent author and guest lecturer on many subjects with talks entitled Sex and the Single Pistol and Wet with More Rain in the Forecast. She's with us today, though, to talk about the value of trees in the landscape. Carol, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
Let's start with a question that seems kind of obvious but really isn't. The function of trees in the landscape.
Well, being a child of the South and growing up in a house built in 1914, pre-air conditioning days, shade pops first and foremost to mind. I guess, you know, of course, beauty. I mean, we've got the aesthetics as well, but screening, too, I think would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Oxygen.
Oh, gosh, that's a little bit important.
We talked about that a couple weeks ago in terms of plant extinction, the value of trees simply for oxygen, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then something else I hadn't thought a lot about is the dynamic load on trees with the wind and the ice. And the trees are geared genetically to respond to that. Talk about that a little bit.
It is interesting. You know, we kind of think of a tree as just sitting out there, but honestly, it's a living organism that certainly responds to its environment. Of course, Alex Shigo was one of the foremost proponents of that, and he's always got very interesting thoughts on it. But wind moves the tree, and the tree responds the way that it moves with the wind, or the amount of resistance that it presents to the wind are all factors in whether or not that tree is going to resist or not be thrown over.
So, Carol, are there advantages of wind as a tree, you know, physiologically develops over its lifetime?
Definitely. In fact, wind helps a tree develop taper, which you probably know is a term that discusses the diameter of the base as it goes toward the tree's top. A thick taper at the bottom, it gives a tree strength where it doesn't lean over and require staking. So wind, every time it blows that tree and physiologically moves that tree, it responds by building up a thicker taper. Okay. In fact, I read somewhere that the king of ancient times had subjects that were instructed to go out and shake his trees in case there wasn't enough wind to make sure that they grew strong and sturdy.
So they've known this for a very long time. So, okay, I'm sure you've seen it. I know Bob and I have as well. Trees that are in people's landscapes that apparently don't have any taper, that kind of look like telephone poles. Mm-hmm. Is that because there wasn't enough wind, or is that because we've done something wrong in the process of placing and planting that tree there?
I think it was probably something done wrong in the growers, from the grower's standpoint, possibly a whole field of trees so that the ones in the center of the field weren't getting enough wind and were also being supported so well by the trees around them that they weren't allowed to move and sway. And also staking, you know, prevents that tree from moving and can make a limber tree without enough taper.
So kind of an argument against staking trees if it's
definitely
not absolutely necessary.
Staking is never a good idea unless it's absolutely necessary. If a tree is just going to blow out of the ground, but besides that being the only reason that you would really need to ever stake a tree, and I hate that I sometimes see that on television shows where they're showing people how to stake, and yet they don't discuss the fact that you shouldn't unless absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. I never thought about leaves either in the sense that they dampen down the wind, not just acting to feed the tree itself, but they have a physiological reason for being there.
That is important, and the size of the shape of the leaf also determines whether or not it's resistant to the wind. I'm an outdoor girl, you know that. I ramble around every morning with my dogs, and I'm always kind of attuned to different things about how wind affects trees. And one thing I've noticed is the sound, how it changes through the seasons too, that the spring sound of the wind through the trees is softer, and as you get toward fall, the clatter and the dry, it's just you can tell the seasons often by the sound, which I think is kind of fun.
And something else homeowners rarely do is when they're buying a tree, say for shade, they never think enough about distances apart, or go out and look at the sun where it is certain times of the day and the shadow that's going to be cast. So talk about planning to plant a tree in those terms.
Well, that is then the first energy crisis that I experienced in my lifetime was back in the 70s. TVA, was Tennessee Valley Authority down here, provides all our electricity, did a big study on the best way to conserve electrical energy, and it was to put shade on the house. And, of course, if you're, again, aware of the way the sun moves across your property and you see that the hottest parts of the day are going to be at noon and in the afternoon, then putting shade where it's going to protect your south and west walls and shield that sun. And I just also am so perturbed these days that people are so afraid to put trees near the house.
Right.
And there's so many ways that you can do that with either smaller trees or by choice of species. But definitely, yes. I mean, if you had it on the north side, it's not going to do you really any good, except aesthetically.
Mm-hmm. So Carol, are there certain species, can you name some, that typically are going to hold on to the ground a little bit better and maybe be a little bit more resistant to ice damage, a heavy snow load, or to wind damage, that sort of thing? You know, because ultimately those are the fears that people have lately, because we've seen so many of those episodes around here and the implications of loaded trees. So,
well, first and foremost, the common bald cypress, which mm-hmm. is one that, because of its shape, it has a strong central leader. Mm-hmm. And small limbs that radiate from that main trunk, so it actually provides less surface for the wind to push. It's just not the huge sail that some rounder trees would present to the wind. It also is extremely strong wood, and it has an extreme taper. If you think about the shape of a cypress, you know that as the roots get near the, if you get near the ground, the roots flare out dramatically. Mm-hmm. It has what's called a buttressed root system and is very unlikely to blow over. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you might lose the top out of a common bald cypress, but again, it's going to be smaller limbs and not going to inflict the damage that a tree with enormous limbs or the big round sail or not be as likely to blow completely over as would old trees that are very prone to blow over. Of course, we all know about Bradford.
Right.
It just splits. It doesn't blow over. Yeah. But pine trees are really easy to blow over.
Mm-hmm. So shallower root system.
Very shallow root system. Even though you wouldn't think about them providing a lot of surface to the wind, mm-hmm. that shallow root system is just not a good thing.
A weak wood, too, huh?
Well, that's a good point, too. They snap easily, yes. Mm-hmm. And the drawback is the cypress doesn't have your big spreading canopy that you would really love to have in a shade tree. And one of the oaks has proven to be a good choice is Shumard,
mm-hmm. right.
One of our great native red oaks, and it's a gorgeous tree to start with and gives you a good spreading crown and will provide fall color for you and wildlife food. So that would be a good choice if you were going for the oaks.
Mm-hmm. And something else people don't think about enough is the architectural effect of the trees vis-a-vis the house. I mean, having an irregular line behind the house and different ups and downs and sideways of a tree. Talk about that a little bit.
I agree. Well, one thing, I don't even like to see a roof line. To me, when I'm looking at a house and all I see is roof, it just goes against my Southern heritage. The house is supposed to be canopied with shade trees in my world.
Yep.
But it softens. You don't have to look at all that harsh geometric line. And also, another choice, and I'm getting into architecture a little bit here rather than landscaping, but dark roofs, you know, absorb so much more heat. Mm-hmm. You've got so many subdivisions filled with low-slung houses with dark roofs and no shade, and you just think about all the wasted energy there.
Yeah. Right.
It's just silly.
So do you know, Carol, if has anybody ever really put like a economic value on these sorts of things?
Yes, and you can find that on the web. I don't have my hands on it right this minute, but there definitely have been studies shown with how much it saves you, and you can put it into dollars and cents. In fact, there's even, I think, equations you can work out. Mm-hmm. And back to architecture a little bit, if anybody's building, another thing that they should consider is the length of the overhang of their roof.
Mm-hmm.
Because actually, any way you can keep sunlight from entering the house, and if you have the right overhang and you're allowing winter light to enter the house, because, of course, the sun is lower, but when the sun is more upright, you're preventing the sunlight in the summer from entering that house.
Mm-hmm.
There are calculations. You can go on the web and you can find those, and you can enter your latitude, and it will tell you exactly how long your overhang should be.
So essentially architectural passive solar concept more than anything else.
True, and that is something we didn't know about in the Deep South growing up. We did design our houses for natural cooling, you mm-hmm. know, high ceilings and big central hallway to move the air through the house, and the transoms above the door so that the heat would escape from the room,
sure.
even if your doors were shut.
Uh-huh.
So I think we've gotten away from all that, and it just makes sense to get back to it.
Indeed.
And people also talk about tree roots as if they went to China, and they really don't. So talk about what the roots do and maybe how you can even plant some things together so the roots will enhance each other.
I know. It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it, that a group of trees would be safer than a tree. But it is very true that is more safe way to use trees for shade. We grew up, and y'all probably remember this, but there was a page somewhere in a book, and And about halfway down the page, you had your soil line, and they had drawn the tree's canopy on the upper half of that page. And then the lower half of that page showed a root system that almost exactly was a mirror image of that tree's canopy.
Right.
And, of course, we all know we've seen enough trees pushed over or blown over that that's simply not true. The tree root system is a wide, shallow pancake. Like 90% of the tree roots are in the top 20 inches of soil. So if you think about a single tree out in your landscape that you've planted for shade, and then the soil gets soaked, and then a big gust of wind catches that big tree, it's just going to push it over. But if you have a group of trees, and we know that tree roots run even further out than the canopy does, then all those tree roots are really knitted together. You basically got an enormous mat of tree roots that are helping to secure each other in the wind. And not to mention the fact that the outer trees of the grove would help to break the force of the wind. So a lot of good reasons to plant a lot of trees, not to mention the fact that shade gardening is a little easier on the... there's fewer weeds in shade. There's still certainly weeds, but it's easier to weed in the shade.
If something else homeowners are guilty of is not wanting to pay to prune a tree and then losing it because it falls over at some point in time. You know, the constant maintenance is so important, but people don't do that.
Well, that's true. If you do good pruning, and of course, I always tell people when I'm teaching the woody plant class for the master gardeners, if you're looking for someone to prune trees and they even advertise topping, then they are on your do not call list.
Right.
You know, you always, of course, want to go back in and remove limbs back at the next crotch or back at the main trunk. And what you're doing then, if you do that properly, is you're really opening up that canopy and allowing the wind to pass through instead of presenting such a solid surface. And it's a beautiful thing for the tree, too, a well-pruned tree that's just, you can enjoy the architectural form and get the limbs up off the roof or away from anything that it might brush against that would create damage. It's a beautiful thing to do to the tree.
On average, Carol, do you think that this is something that people need to consider every 5 years, every 10 years, you know, more often than that, or does it just really depend on the specific circumstances?
Well, I guess it would depend on probably the tree species and the health of the tree. I think, you know, people who love plants probably have a good eye that they could kind of tell when a tree's beginning to need it. If you go to maybe a good campus nearby where they've got well-pruned trees and you kind of look at how they're done well and then go back home and look at your trees and think what could be done or should be done, or just pay an arborist to come out and give you an opinion and see how they look once done properly, and then if they start to get away from that, you would need to call them again.
Because I think ultimately that point right there, that is the most confusing thing to people, because, you know, whether we're talking about a healthy flare of a tree to a well-pruned canopy. So often there are not good examples out and about in the real
world.
Isn't
that the truth?
So, I mean,
so easy to find bad
examples. Usually the bad example, so everybody thinks you're supposed to pile mulch up around the trunk of a tree, and you know what I mean?
I always think about Swarthmore and Penn State. I'm just thinking of places where I know I've seen them do beautiful work on the trees. And, and I don't know what's near you or your audience, but I guess if you called your local urban forestry council and asked their advice about where you could go look, and then that would be a starting point.
And I think, you know, Bernheim Arboretum here and in certain places do provide, in fact, those good examples. But in the urban landscape, it's sometimes slim pickings.
That's right. Yeah. It is.
And it's so true. People will spend money on regular maintenance for their cars or their houses, but they don't do it from the trees and end up paying the price for it.
I know. For some reason, plants just get the shaft.
Yeah, right. Or the chainsaws, in case they
need. This is true. They don't understand quality when they're buying plants, either.
Yeah.
I've often, you know, people know
cheapest.
When they're paying maybe a little bit more for a pair of shoes or a car that they're getting something better, but they don't understand why one nursery's product might be more expensive than another.
Yeah. So speaking about the worst, then, when it's all said and done and we kind of consider some of these things in terms of the home landscape, you know, around the house, taking care of them in terms of how much maintenance is going to be involved to keep them healthy, and how... how, like the Bradford pear, how resistant are they going to be to these pressures? What's the worst thing to pick, Carol?
Bradford.
Bradford pear.
And Leland's, Leland cypress.
Okay.
There's so many trees that are bad picks, and a lot of the trees that are available for sale, unfortunately, are available because they're very fast to produce by the nurserymen,
right,
too.
Exactly.
So it makes them more economical, too, then, for the homeowner to buy. So looking for those trees that are going to be more long-lived and better resistant, you know, surprisingly, you can get a lot of worth for shade and energy conservation out of smaller trees that you don't think of as shade trees. But again, we go back to that business about keeping sunlight from entering the house.
Right.
So if you put, I don't know if y'all do crepe myrtles up there, but
yeah,
we do.
Yeah, they do.
Or even Japanese maples or fringe trees, but if you can get those closer to the house and limb them up so that they shade the windows. You don't want it right in front of the window, obviously, but next to the window where you can limb it up and have it arch over that window and keep that sunlight from entering the home. And that's not going to scare anybody either as far as wind damage.
You know, it's funny, our neighbors out where we live, which is, you know, pretty rural area, but they have a relatively new house, and planted a tree over there, a small tree, like a small flowering cherry. But literally what Tracy did was sit in her chair, and she knew exactly where the sun would blind her in the afternoon on her patio.
Yeah.
And then she said, Andy, okay, no, move a little bit that way. Move a little bit. Okay, that's perfect. You know, and then he put the stake in the ground, and he knew exactly where to plant the tree. So it would, in fact, provide her with the service she wanted in terms of shading, you know, their patio area.
And Janine, that goes back to something. When I teach landscape design, I'm always telling the homeowner that they should probably design on site rather than on paper,
right,
and then transfer that design to paper so they'll have a plan to carry around with them.
Yeah.
But I can't tell looking at a piece of paper. I lose sight of things like the exact sun angle and the views and which way the breeze will move toward the patio and exactly where the thing needs to be put so that it doesn't block my view, but it does block the neighbor's basketball goal.
Exactly.
It's very easy to do on-site and very hard to do indoors.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's a great way to go.
And I think it's a seasonal sort of thing, too. You have to pay attention to how you use the space in what season and what you're trying to achieve.
Very
the sun
much
moves.
So. You don't want your fragile. Keep going to back Japanese maples because there's a huge sale on them locally, and I just bought some very cool ones. But you wouldn't want your fragile Japanese maples, you know, where the kids play ball, or that kind of thing. So you certainly divide your landscape up into different uses and go with that. But another thing that does, when you're looking through shade out into the sunlight, it actually, you're better able to perceive color. And I always thought that was sort of maybe because you had that dark frame and it made the bright colors appear more vivid. But it found out one day by accident that it actually is a physical mechanism of the eye. And I was on my porch and I was looking out on a fall day and enjoying the colors. And I stepped out into the light and they dimmed. And I stepped back into the shade and they brightened. And I realized that when I stepped out into the light that my pupils had to close down to protect my eyes.
So you weren't taking as much in.
So when I step back into the shade again, yes, you're actually able, physically better able to receive color, which is fascinating to me. And, of course, we go back to the human psyche, too, that we wanted to peer out from in the savannah. We wanted to be in the cover and peer out into the open plains to make sure the saber-toothed tiger wasn't sneaking up on us. But there's a whole lot of reasons to get our house sort of covered up a little bit.
More arguments for shade.
Yeah.
don't be preyed upon.
There's a lot of reasons. There's so many reasons.
I saw a tiger in the yard just yesterday. Well, Carol, one last question. We all have ideas and opinions on good trees, shade trees, and so forth, but where should people go, you think, for the best advice to get the best shade tree for that area? You're Tennessee, Mississippi. We're Indiana, Kentucky. Where do you go?
Well, Extension Service is one, and then also the Urban Forestry Councils. There's a lot of good information because they're all about what survives in modern settings as well as what will survive as far as wind throw or ice load. Y'all have to worry more about ice load and snow load than we, but we certainly have that too. So I would start there, and then I would also, I think a drive around an old neighborhood is always a good idea.
Yep.
See what still looks good after all these years.
Yeah.
Huh?
All right.
Yeah.
Let nature be your teacher, and y'all know that. You just use your eyes and your wits and, and what little common sense I have is not much.
In fact,
I was disappointed to read that Lacework Elm was somewhat weak-witted because it's been one of my favorites. And
yeah, it got wiped out here in the ice storm.
Did it really?
Yeah.
Bad.
The two favorite trees next to our house, bald cypress wasn't touched.
Oh.
Two lacework elms smashed to pieces.
Wow.
So very good, I guess, juxtaposition of those that can survive under the load and those who can't. So, and in fact, another place that just popped into my head, that the whole like driver went around old neighborhoods to look at what stands the test of time. Cave Hill Cemetery here another great place. So there we go.
I get chill bumps when I think of that place. Mm-hmm. That is such a treasure.
Yeah, and taken care of well. So you'll see good pruning techniques as well as good variety of trees.
And really, just about any old cemetery is always a great place to go see what's durable.
Yeah.
We've got Elm Hill Cemetery and Memorial Park over in Memphis that have fantastic plantings of old majestic trees. Mm-hmm. So it's always a good idea to go to the old cemeteries and see what's there.
Good. All right.
Well, Carol, thanks again. As usual, you were terrific, and we'll bring you back some other time.
I'd love it.
Carol Reese is a horticulture specialist at the University of Tennessee's Agriculture Extension Service. For more information on Carol and her work, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
There's nothing like a perfect pair for your own orchard. Dr. Richard Bell helps us choose the best coming up after the break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And on to more trees, but specifically this tree provides us with fruit.
Yeah.
And I know that you've enjoyed pears in your own landscape.
I have.
We've enjoyed cultivated varieties, to be sure, but this last, Bob, this last season, we basically picked pears from a tree where, on property where nobody's living.
And isn't that called theft?
No, it's not, because they were all laying on the ground rotten.
Oh,
ground
doesn't count.
And then the deer come and eat it at night, and then the geese come and poop and peck and all that. So, no, really.
So you beat the needy animals
they
to
were
their fruit.
So good.
Okay.
I think I probably had $65 worth of fruit all said and done.
Do you know what they were?
We think it was some sort of Bartlett seedling, but we're not really sure.
Okay.
So how about that? And they lasted in the refrigerator forever, and every time I go for a walk, I take a little bag with me and pick up a few. And
you don't even look guilty.
Ooh, no, I'm saving fruit from rot and death.
Okay, Miss Wendy, whatever you say.
Nobody else is going to use it, so it's recycling.
Okay.
So it's very green, I think.
She says in pear-like tones.
That's right. So, alas, we need to find out more about pears, because I know so many people during the season ask us, about starting home orchards and maintenance issues and varieties and that sort of thing. So Dr. Richard Bell is going to join us today to sort of sort through some of these very details. He is a research horticulturist at the USDA ARS Appalachian Fruit Research Station, which is in Kearneysville, West Virginia. He spends most of his time there as a plant breeder and geneticist working on improving the quality of pears that we have available to us. Breeding objectives include disease resistance, improved production, and quality of fruit. Dr. Bell, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
I'm pleased to be with you.
Great, thanks. First, what are the main objectives of your research at the Appalachia Fruit Research Station there in West Virginia?
Well, it's to develop new pear varieties for both commercial and backyard growers.
Okay.
The major things that we look at, of course, are fruit quality and appearance. Good appeal to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
We look for a range of maturities, anywhere from, say, the beginning of August up until October. Good storage life, especially for the commercial market. Freedom from physiological disorders such as bitter pit and scab.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, the program has been involved in resistance to fire blight. The original reason it was started, actually, was to develop fire blight resistant varieties for the eastern United States.
Mm-hmm.
And about 15 years ago, we started working also on resistance to the insect called the Paracilla. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, because isn't that what they introduced the Asian lady beetle for? Is that right or no?
Yes.
It's, okay.
The anthracorids are some of the natural predators of Paracillas.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, Paracilla is a significant problem from a number of aspects.
Well, Dr. Bell, let's talk some about the old standards. I moved into a 120, 30-year-old house, and there was four or five old pear trees in the yard. I think they were called kefir pears. And they were just loaded, and I don't know how old they were, but they were some marvelous tree, but they were all near the end of their life. They all died within a year of each other, which was kind of remarkable in a way. But what are some of the old standards, and what were their shortcomings?
At least in commercial production, the most important varieties are Bartlett, Bosc, Comice, and Anjou.
Mm-hmm.
They're all susceptible to fire blight, particularly Bartlett and Bosc. Some of them, like Bartlett, can also be susceptible to core breakdown.
And when you talk about core breakdown, is that just essentially like if you cut into it, it would be rotting at its core?
Yeah, well, it's breaking down. It's not actually a rot.
Okay. So it's mealy or something?
Yeah, it's kind of a... It turns brown next to its core, and the tissue loses firmness.
Okay.
And Comice also, in addition to fire blight susceptibility, has a problem with poor productivity. In fact, the only place where it's really grown to any extent is in southern Oregon. Anjou is another major variety. In addition to the fire blight susceptibility, there's a need for anywhere from like 45 to 60 days of cold storage in order to induce normal ripening. It's also susceptible to a number of physiological disorders that are usually related to calcium deficiency and storage scald, which is a browning of the skin as the fruit starts to ripen out of storage.
So because of some of these problems, this is why you have a job, right?
Right.
So what are the names that we, as people that might enjoy a small home orchard, should be looking for as we shop the catalogs this winter if we want to plant out a small pear orchard next spring?
Well, from the USDA program, I would look for Blake's Pride. That was a variety that we released about 10 years ago. It's done extremely well in consumer trials in Oregon and California. Very high quality. It tastes a little bit like Comice. It has a high degree of fire blight resistance. Stores for about 3 months. It's not a long storage pear. But it's done well in commercial orchards in California, and I think it's be an excellent variety for the homeowner.
Okay.
And that's starting to show up in catalogs.
Mm-hmm.
There's another variety that we released called Shenandoah, which is a long storing pear. It's a little bit more acidic than many pears. It's kind of a snappy flavor. It would appeal to someone who likes a little bit more acidity.
Mm-hmm.
But it mellows after about 3 months in storage. So it has very well-balanced flavor after about 2 to 3 months in storage.
Mm-hmm.
We also released Sunrise, and we should be seeing that in nursery catalogs in about 2 to 3 years, I would think. That's a very early ripening pear, as the name Sunrise probably suggests.
Right. Sure.
We pick it about the first week of August. It stores very well for an early season pear, about 3 months. High degree of fire blight resistance. And again, very good consumer acceptance scores, both for flavor and appearance and size.
Mm-hmm.
From the Agriculture Canada program, you can look for Harvest Queen, Harrow Delight. Harrow Sweet is a particularly nice pear that was just released about 8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
All of these have fire blight resistance and good quality. Harrow Sweet tastes a little bit like Bartlett and stores fairly well up through December or January.
Mm-hmm.
No core breakdown, really nice, firm, buttery flesh. a new selection just released from Canada. It's called Harrow Then Sundown, but it will probably be a few years before that's going to be available to nurseries in the United States. Honey Sweet's another old variety from the Purdue University program. That's a very nice fire blight resistant pear, as are Jade and Ambrosia, which came out of the same program just a few years ago.
Well, Dr. Bell, what about fertilization issues? Do you need to cross-pollinate these pear trees?
Yes, all pears pears in general are self-incompatible. You need an unrelated pollinator variety.
Huh.
And one of the ways to check that really is to look at the parentage. You don't want something that's closely related.
Hmm.
For example, Harrow Delight is a seedling of Bartlett, so you wouldn't want to buy Bartlett as a pollinator.
Okay.
For that.
See, these are the details, I think, that sometimes get lost when people plant out.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then they wonder why they're not getting good production. So you want like a mix of people from completely different families if you're a pear.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sounds like our family.
Do wild pears help out?
Yes, and actually some people have suggested using Pyrus betulifolia as a pollinator for European pears.
Huh.
It blooms a little bit earlier than some of the European pears, but I think there's enough of an overlap that it could be useful. There are a number of other European pear species that could be used, but in general, at least in commercial orchards, people, or in the home orchard, people want to plant a tree that they can collect fruit from.
Sure.
Some of the nurseries have pollination charts in their catalogs, but not all of them do. So the best way to check is to look at the description and see if there's anything in there about what the suggested pollinators are.
Mm-hmm. And most good places will have that information, so that may even be like one of those indicators in terms of a more reputable ordering place, huh?
Yes, and if it's provided by, if it's provided by the breeder, in the case of new varieties,
mm-hmm.
we always check cross-compatibility with major varieties, and the Agriculture Canada program also does that.
What about pruning and thinning of the trees?
Pruning is extremely important, I think, to getting sustained productivity and fruit quality. The homeowner will have to establish a strong tree structure that'll bear the weight of the fruit, but also allow light penetration that will foster the development of flower buds, fruit size, and good fruit quality. And I think there are a number of state university extension publications that are quite good in showing how to produce a tree like that. In our area, Penn State has a very good online brochure for the homeowner.
And Dr. Bell, the University of Kentucky Department of Horticulture has a very good one as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So pruning's probably lost on a lot of people too, I'm thinking, and because it is a little detailed. Thinning the fruit, is that something that's, I know it's really important with apples, is that something that's equally important with pears?
Very productive varieties, it's important to get good fruit size. It's perhaps more important to a commercial grower than to a homeowner, but
okay.
if the tree overcrops, if you have too many small fruit on the tree, you can run into a situation where the flower bud development for the next year's crop is inhibited. So you want kind of a balance. You don't want to get into a situation where you get a lot of fruit one year and no fruit the next year.
Okay.
So the general guideline is to thin the fruit to one fruit per cluster
mm-hmm.
at about, when the fruit is about a half inch in diameter.
Okay.
One fruit per cluster and one fruiting cluster every 6 to 10 inches along a branch.
Okay,
I'm curious if they're any more susceptible to late or early frost than, say, cherries, apples, or peaches.
Pears Yeah, pears can be susceptible to spring frost, particularly some of the earlier ripening varieties, such as Anjou, or not ripening, but early flowering varieties, such as Anjou, which can start flowering about 4 days before Bartlett. Mm-hmm. And especially Asian pears, the Japanese varieties tend to start flowering at least 1 week before European pears.
Mm-hmm. One other issue I wanted to touch on, because it was a part of the conversation that we had earlier, Dr. Bell, this whole notion of storage, and you've thrown the word around a bit too when you talked about the different varieties in terms of some have longer storage than others. And I was fascinated because you had explained to me that some or many pears actually require a cold storage for a certain period of time to actually taste like a good pear. So can you talk a little bit about the whole like cool storage effect to maximize our pear experience?
That's generally true of what we call winter pears. And Anjou is one of the most better known examples of this. Conference is another pear. It's not grown commercially in the United States, but the number one pear in England and much of Western Europe. Mm-hmm. Bosque also, to a certain extent, fits into that category. Anjou requires anywhere from 45 to 60 days of cold storage before it will soften. It's just a physical, physiological characteristic of that variety.
So that's so like the whole like pears ripen best off the tree kind of plays into that cold storage reality too. So mm-hmm. you harvest before they're totally ripened, put them in the cold storage, and then they're ready to eat, in a matter of a couple of weeks or a month mm-hmm. or whatever.
Even the early ripening pears are sometimes susceptible to core breakdown if you leave them on the tree to soften. Uh-huh. Even Bartlett will do that. There are a number of varieties, maybe Aurora and Gorham from the New York breeding program, that are not quite as susceptible to that. You can leave them on the tree
and see what happens. Huh. Well, thank you so much, Dr.
Yes, sir,
Bell.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. I've taken my notes, and I'll confer with my husband to see what sort of pear selections we're going to make this winter to add to our orchard.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot. Dr. Richard Bell is a research horticulturist at the USDA ARS Appalachian Fruit Research Station in Kearneysville, West Virginia, where the pear is being perfected for commercial and home gardeners alike. For more information on Dr. Bell's pear research and pears, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a couple questions.
You want to start?
Yes, ma'am.
All right.
This is from Kathleen. I just noticed that my white pine trees have quite a number of inch-long green caterpillars on their end needles. They are slow-moving even in the afternoon sun. I know that feeling. And shaking the tree causes them to fall off the branches. I've not noticed any bud destruction, nor does it seem they are eating the needles. The caterpillars are green with some black marks, thin but without visible hair tufts. Mm-hmm. I am concerned what they're up to, what damage they may cause, and what organic remedy is available.
Okay, sounds like a good description of the pine sawfly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
The caterpillar stage.
Yep.
They're different, like there's a dogwood sawfly, pine sawfly, I think there's a birch sawfly, and they all look pretty similar, Bob. They're, a small green caterpillar with like black stripes down its back and usually like a glossy black head, variations on the theme and size as well. They do eat the needles of the white pines. Usually you don't have that major of an infestation, so it's not that big of a deal. But I have seen, literally, pine trees naked.
Uh-oh.
Because of such dramatic pine saw infestations.
Right.
So it is something to watch. But for now, it's not really the right time because they're getting ready to go cozy up somewhere and pupate for the winter, over the winter. And then they will emerge as the, you know, the fly adult in the spring and then start the process all over again. And then that caterpillar stage, sort of like in June-ish, is when they're going to be smaller and eating more voraciously. And that's when you would want to try to treat them.
With.
Makes sense. And if she wants an organic treatment, BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, is that category of eat
organic.
Mr. Caterpillar, eat this with the BT sprayed on it, and it's going to mess up your gut, and then you're going to die.
You know?
But the key to BT, to, in terms of it being more successful, is to make sure you do it early on when the caterpillars are small.
Right.
So, you know, go out there and look for and pay attention because the product will be way more effective if you get the caterpillar when they're small.
What if the tree's about 20 feet tall? That's always a problem for people. We have to bring somebody in from the outside to deal
with it? I mean, again, you determine how bad it is.
Yeah.
Because honestly, if it's not that bad, then don't worry about it. You know, it's, the birds will probably take care of most of them. I'm more, you know, kind of talking about major infestations where you feel like it's going to defoliate the whole tree. A few here and there, that's just nature of some meals for birds and other things. And she's doing the right thing. If she shakes it and they fall to the ground, and, you know, and then walk around with shoes and
stomp
smash
on
them. You know my policy.
The kinder, gentler, Miss Wishy at work,
Well, you know, you got to balance all of these things.
I hear
you. You know, use your reason to see if you need to control or just turn the other cheek.
I'm a pretty balanced guy.
I know you are. All right, here's one from Joe. We have three gray pollies, a Mahonia.
Yeah.
They're in need of trimming and shaping. When is the best time to do this that will most benefit the plant?
It's a neat plant and getting a little more popular. It's got real long, sharp needles or leaves, I'm sorry, and great fall color. But basically, I think late winter, early spring is the best time to do it. And they can get real big. Mine are 5 or 6 feet tall. They have this real funky yellow flower, late winter, early spring.
Bells, clusters of bells.
Yeah,
It's
interesting.
Yeah, it's nice. But yeah, late winter thing is good for a lot of plants that are vigorous because once you make those pruning cuts, then bam, new growth comes on and the plant fills out a little nicer don't you think?
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, if you have a question, you can get a hold of us in several ways.
Visit the homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@wfpl.org. Call us at 502-814-8246. And it's not too late for Christmas cards at 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Well, Miss Wishy, here's a Latin word of the week I think Joe Stalin and Karl Marx might have approved of.
They probably would approve of this, in fact. The Latin word of the week is communis, which means common, general, or growing in company.
Well, it's not communist.
No, it's not communist.
Oh.
I guess you could say communist.
I just did, yeah.
I would say communis.
Okay.
What do you think?
You're the...
You say tomato, I say tomato.
You're the grand leader here.
Yeah. Communis.
Okay.
You know how you accent the second syllable typically in Latin, so that would be my guess. All right. So, common, general, or growing in company. Carex communis.
The fibrous root sedge.
Fibrous root sedge. I'm thinking that communis also might suggest a little bit of I have a really good ability to reseed myself or naturalize myself.
I have fibrous roots. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Camelina communis.
Asiatic dayflower.
Ferula communis.
The giant fennel.
Think about how fennel can be, well, quite frankly, a little aggressive.
Yeah.
But ferula communis, I think that's a fabulous name, ferula. Giant fennel. Myrtle. Myrtus communis.
I'm sorry. Myrtle, another great name.
Mm-hmm. Juniperus communis.
Oh, the creeping juniper.
Creeping juniper,
That can be pretty common.
And that's common, sure. Pyrus communis.
Funny you should mention this one today.
Mm-hmm.
The wild pear.
The wild pear, that's right. And if you don't mow a field for a while, you get a lot of wild pears popping up.
Oh, yeah.
Can take that from experience here. Ricinus communis.
This one's fun. The castor bean plant.
Castor bean plant.
Poison,
as long as you don't eat it.
Yeah. But tall and funky.
Tall and funky and growing in company, I suspect. So, yes, if you see communis, it suggests it's a common or, you know, general sort of plant, or growing in company, which I think suggests, you know, the ability to reseed itself or naturalize itself. So I don't know. Should it be a marker of warning, perhaps?
Only in Moscow.
Only in Moscow. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we take a look at Brush Cat, a book on trees, the wood economy, and the most dangerous job in America.
Homegrown is produced by the always pro-American Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.